Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Are you a Survivor fan? Then you have to check out Rob Has a Podcast, hosted by Survivor competitor Rob Cesternino. Every week, he'll be recapping the upcoming season of Survivor so you don't miss any of the action. Plus, Rob is celebrating his 10th year podcasting, so you know that he is a total pro. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and many of your favorite podcast listening apps. Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Jared Dubin, talented freelance writer. A lot of his work is at 538 now, but he is producing good material all over. And also, he has a really interesting Patreon that you can check out. But we talked about a lot of different concepts about the trade deadline, title contention, and everything in between. And so it's a wide-ranging conversation. You know, we get down some tangents, potential playoff series, everything else, but I think you'll really enjoy it. Episode is brought to you by BetOnline. Go to betonline.ag and use that Podcast One promo code for a 50% sign-up bonus. And I also want to let you know that we are now on Spotify. So I've been asked about that at various moments in time. So if you prefer to use Spotify and you've been toughing it out, not using it for this podcast, you can check it out over there. Really do appreciate that. This show runs about an hour 10. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
This is always, now that the league changed the trade deadline, a really interesting time to kind of take stock of where things are, because we know what these teams, broadly speaking, are going to look like. You know, there could be some buyout candidates here and there. I mean, it's possible Marvin Williams and MKG are two of the bigger names that get moved in that circumstance, and obviously the trade deadline has already passed. So I'll start with opening the floor to you of just your big takeaway of February so far.
I'm actually working on something right now. Like, I think we're kind of underrating how much the Bucks might be better than everybody else. You look at it right now, they're 46-8. The next closest team is the Lakers, who I think are 4.5 games back. That's an enormous amount at the All-Star break. And you look at it in net rating, the Bucks are 4.3 points ahead of the next closest team, which is the Lakers. That's the same as the difference between the Lakers and the 11th place team. And going all the way back to 1997, that is the largest difference in net rating between the first and second place team. It's the Bucks to the Lakers and the 97 Bulls to the 97 Pistons, both 4.3 points in net rating difference. I think we might be underrating how good the Bucks are, especially when you look at what they've done these last couple games, even without Giannis. Obviously they won the other night, and then they had a pretty big comeback against Indiana, ultimately fall short last night, or perhaps two nights ago, whenever people are listening to this. That team is just really, really good, and they don't do anything poorly, and they didn't even need to make any big moves at the deadline. And then they went and got, like, essentially the perfect buyout guy for them in Marvin Williams. It's scary how good that team is right now.
It is. And to use comparisons for last year. So last year, using Queen of the Glass's garbage filter, the Bucks had a 9.1 point differential. And this year, that's 11-8. And worth remembering that last year's number two team was the Golden State Warriors. They don't exist anymore. Last year's number three team was the Jazz at plus 6.7. Using Queen the Glasses filter, the Celtics actually jumped the Lakers, but they're both close. They're about plus 7. And it is such a strange circumstance, because there is this combination of feelings, which is the Bucks were also the best regular season team last year, and they not only didn't win the championship, they didn't even make the NBA Finals. But both the team that beat them and the team that was the number two in the NBA, which are two different squads, both don't exist in that form anymore. So I think the underrated possibility here is that the Bucks are similarly good to how good they were last year, but that the other competitors aren't as dangerous. So the idea that even if they're worse, like let's say on a talent level, I think they're going to miss Brogdon and all that type of stuff, than last year in the playoffs, it might just be that it's an easier field for them to get through.
It might be an easier field. I think, you know, people were like, oh, they have to prove it in the playoffs. And like, they did prove it in the playoffs. They took the champs to the brink in the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, it's not like they weren't good enough to win the title last year. There were some matchup issues that they couldn't deal with in that particular, or not necessarily couldn't deal with, but didn't deal with appropriately in that particular series. And then, you know, there are – I think the concern for me this year with them is the thing that was not talked about as much of a concern last year, but was to me sort of the reason that they weren't able to win that series, is Mike Budenholzer's willingness to extend his guys to, you know, 38, 40, 42 minutes like a lot of other coaches will do in the playoffs. Like, he came out and straight up said, like, I don't think the solution is playing Giannis more minutes. And that was after the series where the Raptors kind of took control in, what was it, game four, game five? I don't remember what it was. But he, you know, he said that, and I would imagine that he probably still believes it. And that to me is the thing that's more likely to hold them back than, like, you know, Giannis is not an elite 3-point shooter or something like that. Like, to me, it's more about the decision making and the way they will actually use their roster in the playoffs. And then, like, this is something that's been a criticism of Bud for a while now. Like, is he willing to, you know, have another club in his bag, or willing to, you know, quote unquote, play left-handed and at least adjust things slightly from the way they play in the regular season? That's something they've not really done over the years either. And I mean, maybe it's irrelevant this year just because of how good this team is and how much better they look than pretty much everybody else right now. But, you know, if it's me, I'm more concerned about those two things than I am about, you know, they don't have Brogdon anymore, or about Giannis doesn't shoot threes, or even Giannis can't seem to make free throws anymore.
The free throws are a concern. I'm wondering if some teams will go to hack a Giannis. And one of the other considerations there is that Milwaukee, this is kind of a counterintuitive thing that I've been working on. Nate and I have done so many of their games for the live show that I've been, like, you know, you get to think about a team more. And what I realized is Milwaukee is so good at getting back in transition defense that one of the concessions that a team makes when they go to Hacka is that you're always facing a set D. Milwaukee, you're basically facing a set D most of the time anyway, so that consequence isn't as severe. So I think that could be a consideration. And, you know, their offense is, even their half-court offense has been very good. I believe it's actually was the best in the league last time I checked. I don't know if that's shifted in the last couple of days. And another element of this that I think is really working in the Bucks' favor is the tentative framework of the bracket. So it's obviously still too early. Some people, you know, it's worth remembering that the All-Star break is far, far away from the halfway point in the NBA. Right now, the Bucks have played 54 games. So, not, you know, they have 28 left. So, 54, 28. So, we're basically two-thirds of the way through the season. And the way that it looks to me like it's shaking out is that, and this isn't a surprise, that as regular season teams, the Raptors and Celtics have been better. I didn't expect either of those teams to be as good as they have been. But now that we kind of have this baseline for how good those teams are, they play good defense. Toronto's battled through injuries, and so going through that. But so what that means, if I'm right, and the Raptors and Celtics are the two and the three in either order, then that means the Sixers are on the same side of the bracket, and that also means that the Sixers presumably play the Heat in the first round, and it does make it more likely that the Bucks play the Sixers, and I'm still a believer that the Sixers will make life hard on Milwaukee, but it also means that they'll only play one of the Sixers in Miami, and it means that it will be in the second round, which I actually think might be better for them than if, like, you're facing potentially a Sixers team that is more congealed, better fitting together in the conference finals.
I think that makes sense. I also think if they happen to play Miami, I remember last year when, you know, Miami was throwing the zone at everybody and everybody was kind of discombobulated by it, the Bucks, like, absolutely tore it apart.
And that seems like something intellectually Budenholzer would be very good at handling.
Yeah, I mean, I asked him about it when they were here in New York. I was like, you know, what are you guys doing differently against that zone? And he basically was just like, we're not playing against it because we're just pushing the ball up the court as quickly as possible so we can, you know, take shots before they get set in it. And obviously that's what everybody says they want to do when a team is going into a zone. But because they have Giannis and he can actually get down the floor faster than literally anybody in any situation, and even if there are guys back, he can just sort of go past them or around them or through them anyway, it's a little bit different for the Bucks than it is for a team like, say, you know, like the Rockets, who, when I wrote my zone defense story last year, were really struggling against zone defenses at the time. Or even like the Sixers, where it's like, Simmons can do that, but most of the rest of the guys are, you know, not joining him on that break because they're a little bit slower. That's why teams are playing more zone against them than, I believe, against any team in the league. But even when the Bucks were in the half court against that zone, they were really tearing it apart, like, quite a lot. And one of the things they were doing was screening the side of the zone, having Bledsoe take the ball to the wing, and then giving him another screen right away back into the middle. And that worked really, really well for them. And I'm interested to see if they do wind up playing the Heat, and the Heat do wind up using a lot of their zone, how Miami adjusts to that. Because it's not the most complicated thing in the world, you know, guarding one screen and then guarding another screen back in the opposite direction. But it is something that gave them a lot of problems last year when those two teams played.
Another benefit for the Bucks in terms of the bracket is that the bottom two teams in the East are not exactly inspiring. And it looks to me like Brooklyn is going to stay ahead of Orlando. And I would say Brooklyn, because their star players are more likely to play, you know, like that Kyrie being back makes the Nets better than the Magic, and John Isaac, an important part of the Magic, doesn't look like he's coming back this year. We don't know that officially yet, though they did apply for that disabled player exception. And
right, if they applied for it, doesn't that mean essentially he can't come back?
No, that means if it's granted, then that means that means the doctors expected it. It doesn't mean that he cannot. Basically, you can defy the doctors. But also remember, Orlando basically did use it, so it's not like they've got any. I don't even know if it was granted. I haven't heard anything definitively on that. But basically, what that means is But in this case, it probably does, because I believe the standard is more likely than not that they won't be available to play until the end of the playoffs. And so if they expect that it's more likely than not that a player won't be there for the playoffs, then we're talking here late April. We're not talking June, July. We're not talking late June. So that would be pretty significant. So I think that's a fair assumption. But yeah, I haven't heard if it was granted. That's something I should look into. But either way, I mean, I think the Bucks, you know, it could be one of those maybe like more of a rock fight 4 or 5 game series, but I don't think they would have too much trouble with the Magic. The Magic's offense would just flatline against them, and Orlando doesn't have the shooting to even have hot games that would really give the Bucks trouble. There's that stat about how a lot of the Bucks only have 8 losses, but a series of them have been to teams with the high water mark of their 3-pointers for the season. And that makes sense, because that's the shot that Milwaukee concedes, and it's high variance, so if it goes in a lot, then that makes the Bucks more vulnerable. And yeah, I think they're really well situated. Also important for them that the Lakers didn't make any additions at the deadline. And I mean, the two highest profile, the two buyout guys that we know already, not that they would have were perfect fits for the Lakers, but it looks like those guys are going elsewhere. Marvin Williams to the Bucks and MKG to the Dallas Mavericks. So,
and they didn't get Andre Iguodala because he went to Miami.
So it's going to be harder for the Lakers. And Jared Carlson is staying retired, so they're not getting him either. That means it's going to be
the Clippers beat them for Marcus Morris.
Sure. So it's going to be harder for the Lakers. The Clippers beating Marcus Morris might be a challenge, because the Clippers could win the West as well, so they don't get as much of a benefit there. And we'll see. Maybe Iguodala being in Miami actually affects things, because Miami could face Milwaukee in a second or a conference finals round series, depending on how things shake out. So I think that the Bucks are looking good in the East, and then the West is just, I think that I'm still sorting out those teams. I watched a lot of the Lakers on Wednesday night, because we did them for the live show, and I'm very conflicted on the Lakers, because when they're humming, their defense looks great. Their offense, you know, like even last night against the Nuggets, there were times where they were struggling, but then they had some high pick and roll with Davis. Davis hit some threes in overtime. But LeBron doesn't look to me to be the same scorer that he was. His passing is still ungodly and all that. And he's playing much, much better defense, which is good. And it's important for the Lakers' success this year. It's a big part of why they've been the best team in the West in the regular season. But thinking about how they scale doesn't exactly fill me with confidence the way that it has some other LeBron teams that were going into the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, for me with the Lakers, my issue is, and look, I mean, if you have LeBron and Davis, like, you are a title contender, and especially when you have a shooter who, when he's on his game, like Danny Green, is, you know, another guy that you can count on all the time. And obviously he's played in probably certainly more important games than Davis, and more important games than just about anybody else in the league, save for LeBron, right? Like, between the Spurs and then last year with the Raptors. I mean, he's been in so many big games. It's not like you have to worry about Danny Green, except for, like, when he's trying to take a floater and the occasional, like, what are you doing, Danny, type of pass. But the issue for me is, like, the Lakers have been playing big all year, and it's worked really well for them. When you get in the playoffs, do you trust JaVale McGee and Dwight Howard to split 36 minutes a game? I'm not sure how you can game out whether or not you should, until you actually see them in that setting, I do think it's a little bit of a concern, and why I would like to see them get, you know, on the buyout market, a sort of like a combo big man type that can guard centers so Davis doesn't have to, but can also, you know, not just be a pure lob threat, because I don't think Kuzma necessarily fills the type of big guy they're looking for next to him. And then the point guards, like Avery Bradley's not really a point guard.
Yeah, they don't really have anybody I'm comfortable with handling the ball other than LeBron.
Yeah. So it's like there's two spots there that I don't know what they're going to do. You know, essentially the two spots next to LeBron, AD, and Danny. You know, maybe it's KCP. Maybe it's Avery Bradley. Maybe it's both of those guys. Maybe it's Kuzma. Maybe it's Dwight. Maybe it's JaVale. But right now I don't know who it is. And that would be a slight concern to me, because having options is good. Knowing who your guys are is better.
Having good options is better too, because then you could – and that's one of the differences between them and, let's say, like the Clippers. Like I like the Clippers' possible lineups combinations better. Like they have fewer holes, and yeah, LeBron's going to play a ton of minutes, so that those concerns aren't as real. But we saw it last year with Joel Embiid, that a team can lose a lot of ground when their star is off the court, and it can be hard to reconcile that. And if they try to have Davis on the floor during those minutes, then that's less time for LeBron and AD to play together, and you get into all those problems. And the other big concern that I have for the Lakers in terms of championship window, this isn't about winning the, like, getting the best record in the West or anything like that, is that when you think about them facing the teams that I think are their two clearest opponents, I've said, for me, the top contending tier has been three teams basically since the beginning of the year. It's been the Lakers, the Clippers, and the Bucks. The Bucks have the single best rim protection defense in the league right now, maybe in the history of the NBA. And the Lakers do a lot of their damage there. And so the Bucks do overhelp. Sometimes they freak out. Maybe they'll give up shots. But remember, I talked about just the basic idea that the Lakers don't have other guys who can handle the ball. So if the Bucks can use their length and close out, then those guys have to make dribbles and decisions and pass and all that. And it creates big problems. And then against the Clippers have, I think their defense is going to step up. They have players who can do that. They have a history of it mostly in other cities, but that's okay. But also, both of those teams are reliant on these big, small forward, power forward types that are very hard to defend. And unless it's going to be LeBron, who isn't best in that role and hasn't been for years now, they don't have options. Like, that was the biggest reason why I was supporting Marcus Morris going to the Lakers, or Iguodala, should he have been bought out and everything like that, is they don't have other people. So whether it's LeBron is shouldering so much of the offensive burden, or that you lose him as a help defender or anything like that, they have capable defenders at other positions, but they don't really have anybody for that responsibility. And that I think is the part that might be the story of this Lakers, you know, like that, as much as they did a much better job building this year than they did last year, where it was just such a disaster, and then LeBron's injury exacerbated it and everything else, is LeBron's window is narrow. I mean, the guy is already 35, and even though he's remarkable, there's still going to be some degradation. I think we've already seen some. And his window is narrow. So basically, Kyle Kuzma, they made a bet that Kyle Kuzma could be a part of this, and I don't feel comfortable with that.
I'm kind of in the same boat with Kuzma. So there are, I think, three things that you said that I want to get thoughts in on. The first one is the specific potential issues for the Lakers against the Bucks in terms of the rim protection. That's something that I hadn't thought about, and is a really good point, and it made me really angry that I didn't think of it myself. Then the specific issues against the Bucks and the Clippers in terms of having big wings to guard them. I think they're going to try to get by with like smaller guys against that guy, or even Kuzma against that guy. But, you know, Danny Green can guard some threes, but he can guard like Paul George type threes that get by on, you know, smoothness and being able to blow by guys and things like that. I know they've been teammates there for Kawhi's whole career, so we haven't seen him try to guard Kawhi really yet. That is not going to go well if you try to put Danny on Kawhi. He just doesn't have the strength to deal with him, and then certainly he doesn't have the strength or the size really to deal with Giannis. You know, you put him on Chris Middleton, I think you'll be okay, but against Giannis, it's going to be a problem. So I do agree with you that they have that specific issue defensively. I think that their thing is they're going to try to overwhelm you with their size on the other end. And that's where the question about, you know, Dwight and JaVale comes into me. Like, can you really count on those guys when you need to? The second thing that I wanted to mention was with the options that the Lakers and Clippers have in terms of the guys who are going to play next to their stars, the thing that leads me to think the Clippers' options are better is that depending on who they throw out there, even the other three guys surrounding Kawhi and PG, they can go so many different directions and throw you so many different looks. With the Lakers, really the only different look they can present is, are we going to go big with Dwight or JaVale or quote-unquote small with Kuzma? The other two guys, whether it's, you know, Danny or KCP or maybe both of them, and then Bradley or Rondo or Caruso, like, nothing's really changing about the way the Lakers are playing because LeBron's going to be handling the ball anyway. You'll have either one shooter or two shooters out there with them. And the only thing that changes is whether you're big with one of the centers or small with Kuzma. The Clippers can show you so many different options depending on whether they're using Beverly or Lou Williams or Landry Shamet or Marcus Morris or Montrezl Harrell or Zubac. Like, any combination of those guys changes things significantly. They're a little bit more able to shapeshift than the Lakers are. And I think that that's especially important because you need to be able to play different ways against different teams.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point. And also, I trust Doc Rivers to choose the right matchup for the right time more than most coaches. I think that he knows what his guys are. And that's, I mean, to me, that's one of the lingering effects of that series they had against the Warriors last year was they had some really good counters. And sure, the Warriors team they were facing wasn't exactly the same one that was dominating the league due to injuries and everything else. But they did a nice job of punching over their weight. And I always remember that when a coach does that. I also thought, even, again, with the injuries, Nick Nurse did a good job of that last year. And I think that even with different personnel that could happen again this year, Stevens has done it too. So if that was a potential second-round series, would be really, really exciting. But yeah, I think that the Clippers, and adding Marcus Morris helps there. Just another guy to throw out some of their assignments. And he does bring downsides. I mean, Morris has, offensively, he can shoot, but there's a difference between being a capable shooter, a willing shooter, and the other things you can tape off. He is not a low-usage guy most of the time. So that could be a big problem. But just having another big body who can slow down LeBron, maybe slow down AD a little bit, really does have some value for them.
Yeah, I mean, we were literally just talking about the relative lack of guys the Lakers have to throw at big wings. I mean, the Clippers have Kawhi, PG, Marcus Morris, like, you could even try, like, JaMychal Green. Like, I don't know if throwing Harrell on Giannis would be a good idea, but you could try it if you want to.
They could try it, like, with Zubac. I honestly don't think it would be the worst idea.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you look at the Heat now have something similar. Like, they could try Crowder, they could try Solomon Hill, they could try Bam, they could try Jimmy, they could try Iguodala. Like, they have a lot of guys to throw at that type of player too. And that is the one thing I think that stands out with the Lakers that they don't have.
Another team that doesn't have that is the 76ers. Like, they basically, they're five.
They have to use Simmons basically in that role.
They have to, and then that takes a lot out of him. And Simmons is a wonderful defender and an underappreciated one, but I don't love him in that part of it. You know, that to me, that's not my favorite thing that Ben Simmons does. Defensively, he can be disruptive, but as a one-on-one, you know, lock-and-trail type of defender, I just don't see that as the best thing he does. Sort of like Tatum.
I mean, the best thing Simmons does defensively, right? The best thing Simmons does defensively is that he can guard everybody,
right?
But in the context of a specific matchup, that's not quite as valuable. When you need, like, we need to guard Kawhi, then being able to guard Kawhi and PG and Patrick Beverley and Landry Shamet and Montrezl Harrell doesn't have quite as much value because you're just looking for someone to guard one guy, and he can do it. But that's not, like, the benefit of Simmons is more versatility than I'm going to shut down this one specific matchup.
And it might end up being one of those long tail type of things. And I've harped on it since it happened, that even though Elton Brand identified Tobias Harris as being that guy in the starting five who could complement Embiid and Simmons and whoever else it was going to be, the rest of it turned over so much over the course of the year. And I'm more skeptical of that than Brand was, but we'll make that decision what it is. The part that changes it was the resources that they sacrificed in order to get Tobias Harris. Because you could think about it that, especially considering it looks now like the Clippers were not going to offer, even if they hadn't gotten what they did, that they weren't going to offer Tobias Harris a full max, that they could have potentially gotten Harris, and let's even ignore the difference between the higher raises and all that type of stuff and the fifth year, they could have gotten him without having to give up Shamet and those picks. And those assets.
And then look how desperate they've been for shooting that they just had to put Korkmaz in the starting lineup and that they, you know, had to obviously not a ton of value to give up 3 second round picks for Glenn Robinson and Alec Burks, but like if you had Shammah, you don't have to do all that maneuvering.
Right, or you could do all that maneuvering and you get better. You know, you get more options. And remember, they also gave up firsts in the Tobias Harris trade as well. And first that ended up becoming a part of the, I believe, I'd have to run the number, that became a part of the Paul George trade. So, like, the benefits that the Clippers got from the Sixers overpaying helped create their powerhouse as well. And also just having Shamit, who I think is a good player, and one of that optionality pieces that we talked about for the Clippers before. So, yeah, I think that the Sixers, the challenge that they're going to face, and this is Brett Brown's challenge right now, but it's Elton Brand's challenge moving forward, is they don't have really any other looks. That, you know, I'm happy they got GR3. I'm happy they got Alec Burks. And maybe there are moments in time where one or both of those players can be a part of a starting or closing lineup. But generally speaking, this team is going to rise and fall with the five that Brand put together. And there will be times that works beautifully. I still believe in their defensive ceiling, especially if Josh Richardson, and I think he will, comes back 100%. But that is such a gigantic gamble because they just don't have other options.
Yeah, I think Richardson, we haven't really seen, you know, full strength most of the season. Obviously, he's missed a decent amount of time with injuries. Like, he might be able to change things if he's full strength and, you know, the guy that we saw him be last year. I do think that provides them a little bit of a different look than they've had for a bunch of this year, just because he hasn't really been himself for a lot of the season. Even when he was healthy, quote unquote, he was dealing with, you know, issues here and there. So I do think that's a little bit different for them if by the time the playoffs roll around, he's like full strength and the guy he was for most of last season.
Still plenty more to talk about with Jared Dubin, but first a message from BetOnline. The drive to March has begun for college basketball's finest, and the NBA's contenders are looking to make a move leading into the All-Star break. Even though football is done, this is a great time to get involved at BetOnline. If you want to do the All-Star game, you absolutely can. Team LeBron versus Team Giannis, and then games will start again in about a week, and that'll be an exciting time to get back into it with the trade deadline acquisitions. But also you have college basketball. Maryland and Michigan State, UVA and North Carolina, some really exciting games going on all over the slate. And for those of you who are passionate about college basketball, of course, local games going on all the time, which is really exciting. And go to betonline.ag and use the Podcast1 promo code for a 50% sign-up bonus. Whether it's a game that you're going to be watching anyway and you want to make it more interesting, or if you think you know something that the odds makers do not, either way, you can go to BetOnline and check it out. Also, they have a ton of other action going on depending on what you're interested in, including MMA, and to find something that interests you. It's a great thing to check out, and make sure that if you do, go to betonline.ag and use that Podcast1 promo code for a 50% sign-up bonus. Tells them that you came from us as well, which is great. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. We've brought them up a couple times, but I want to spend a little bit more time talking about Miami. And I'm not as sold as some are on their absolute ceiling this year, because the offense concerns me. They don't have enough players that can generate that either as lead guys or as complementary players. You know, I don't think Hero's all the way there yet. Dragic has his moments, but I don't think he can be an engine. Kendrick Nunn, I'm not all the way there. When you're playing the best of the best, those guys, I mean, that's part of the reason the Heat have been a wonderful regular season team, and they will continue to be. But what they did at the deadline was stunning, not as much to me because of who they added, but how little they sacrificed to get better and to get cheaper in the long term.
All I had left in my life as a basketball fan was hating Pat Riley. And I have nothing anymore. Like, he goes and takes his terrible contracts and turns them into Iguodala and like almost Gallinari. And he really doesn't have to give up, from their perspective, much of anything, because they've been playing so well this season, even without Justice Winslow. It was like he clearly was like kind of superfluous to them. And that's all they had to give up to get, you know, the upgrade that they wanted. Like, he makes me so angry. Like, oh God, it's so annoying. I do think I agree with you that I'm not necessarily quite sold on their, you know, top level ceiling. I think if they would have gotten Gallo, I would have been all in. I would have been like, this is the team that's going to challenge the Bucks in the East. I don't know that I necessarily would have thought that they were actually going to beat them, but I would have been like, this is like the clear cut second team if they had gotten Gallo. Now I think they're, you know, sort of in the mix with Boston, Toronto, Philly, maybe even Indiana if they can figure out how to get Oladipo worked into what they had been doing earlier in the season. You know, I think that they're kind of a step behind the other team, those other teams right now, even though Philly hadn't been playing that well until, what was it, two nights ago when they had the great win, or was it last night? I don't remember. But, you know, Miami, I think, sort of interestingly, kind of reminds me of what I had just said about Simmons, where the best thing about Miami is all the different things that they can do, and that's good. But in the context of one series, it's not quite as valuable. And if you have to play a certain way to beat a certain team, I don't know that they have the top level way of playing in each of those ways. You know what I mean? It's sort of like a discount version of the Clippers, where they can play a lot of different ways, but the ceiling on each of those ways is not quite as high as it is with the Clippers, because the Clippers have Kawhi and Paul George, and the Heat have Jimmy and Bam, and Jimmy and Bam are both really good, but they're not as good as Kawhi and PG.
I broadly agree with you, and also just on the concept of comparing them to the Clippers, something I've become more obsessed with over the years, and Kawhi is a big part of this, and LeBron is too, is undeniability. So it's, even if you can't do many things, can you do something so well that even if the other team games for it, they can't stop it? And Kawhi's mid-range, you know, Kawhi-so ball, all that type of stuff, that qualifies. But Miami doesn't really do anything on either end of the floor that I think fits. And the versatility for them, I'm trying to piece together in my head how a Miami-Philly series would shake out, because both of those teams have so much more defensive upside than offensive upside. And one concern that I have from Miami's perspective there is that, yeah, they can do some of these zone concepts. I trust Spo as a playoff coach significantly more than Brett Brown. But Joel Embiid, to me, has the potential to be not only the best player on the floor, but the way he can attack a defense is a lot harder, unless Miami does some really cool scheme stuff trying to get the ball out of his hands and that deny entry passes, that sort of thing. I could see a circumstance where Embiid wins the Sixers one or two games and that their defense and the rest of them is stifling enough that they do it, but that would be a really fascinating series.
Miami, you would assume, basically plays zone like more than any team has played zone in any playoff series in that case, in that particular series, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, that's the leader in the clubhouse as of now for me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to look this up right now based on the games that they've played so far. I know that Miami played a significant amount of zone against them earlier in the year. Yeah, so they played zone on 41% of possessions in one game, 40% of possessions in another game, and 25% of possessions in the third game against them. That is the first, second, and third most any team has played zone against, or first, second, and fourth most any team has played zone against Philly all season. Dallas played 35% in one of those games. And let's see. There have only been, so yeah, among the, those are in the top five most zone games, or sorry, top seven most zone games all season. So it would be.
And you know what else is all crazy? Zone. They don't play each other at all between now and the end of the season. They're done.
Yeah, they only play three times.
Yeah, and so they're as far as when I checked the schedule, I think all of those games are done, and so then that means we're going to get even less data to work with, and I think that series is looking pretty likely. You know, 30 games out, we don't know exactly where things are going to go, and it's possible that one of the teams could try to move their way out, and I think the way to do that would be blow. But that requires the Pacers winning some games. They've been dealing with this losing streak, and the passage of time will help just because Oladipo is going to get healthier, and they can do some better things to figure out how to use him. But yeah, I mean, the East is going to be fascinating, and also something to keep an eye on for the top end is, even if Boston and Toronto are very motivated to be in the 2-3s, they avoid Milwaukee as long as possible, they're probably going to fight pretty hard to, you know, rest versus pushing is going to be a big challenge for Stevens and Nurse when you consider the huge difference between the 7 seed and the 6 seed this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, those two teams are going to have to play each other in the second round.
And the home court there, like, that's another great point.
Yeah.
But let's jump to the West. I mean, there are a couple different. We've already, of course, talked about the Lakers and Clippers a fair amount here, and the Rockets are the other gigantic discussion from the trade deadline that we haven't discussed. And I'm so happy they made this bet at some point. I don't know if this was necessarily the year that I would have liked it most, just because I don't think this is their best year of contention, but I'm pretty excited about it.
It's super fascinating. And like, look, I get people being angry about teams going to one extreme or another, but like, I don't see how people can complain everybody plays the same way and then get angry about the Rockets playing so much differently than everybody else. Like, those two complaints seem kind of incongruous to me. I think it's really fascinating, and I think it's probably something that Mike D'Antoni has been wanting to do for a while. I believe it was Simmons that brought this up, or maybe it was Zach that brought this up, where D'Antoni has been talking about like his one regret from the Phoenix years was that they didn't go all in enough. Can't say that about the Rockets. They have gone completely all in on what they've been pushing the edges of these last few years. And something that I'm interested to see is how much this changes their shot distribution, just the Morey ball rate that they've got going. I wrote something early last season on, you know, the erosion of their math advantage, because essentially everybody in the league started playing like them, and it seemed like they had hit a ceiling in terms of the percentage of their shots they could take from, you know, inside the restricted area or inside the paint and outside the three-point line, in like the lows. Maybe they vaulted up into the high 80s, and that provides them a little bit more of an advantage than even they had had, you know, in the first year or the second year of the D'Antoni Harden era, when they, you know, had one of the three or four best offenses of all time. You know, if they get up into the high 80s, maybe they get back into that range.
That's a really good thought, and I think that's a part of the rationale. And the other part of it was Houston now has much better personnel to defend the way they wanted to defend in the first place. And I don't know that it's going to work against everybody. I think they're, you know, especially the Clippers. Like, I could see it being a big problem, because switching everything works well against teams that attack certain ways, but then against other ones, the Clippers can just get Kawhi against whoever they want, and he'll just brutalize that player. And the Clippers have the defensive chops to kind of handle what the Rockets are going to throw at them. They don't have the perfect roster to defend James Harden, but I think they have a lot of guys that can take time on it, and that will be interesting to watch. Also, it wouldn't shock me at all if the Clippers do a good job on Russ, just because of the personnel that they have, the amount of looks that they can throw, and they have a lot of smart veteran defenders, including guys that have faced Russ in playoff series at various different places. And I think that the Rockets, they're definitely more interesting this year. This was a question Nate and I got in our Patreon mailbag that came out on Wednesday, was, did this improve their title odds? And my answer was absolutely. Even with the possibility, which I don't think is necessarily true, that they didn't improve on a talent level, the idea that when you are not the best team, the biggest way, other than improving a lot, to strengthen your title odds is by increasing your variance. Because increasing your variance means that you can win a series or win two series, and there's a chance that it all falls apart, but there was always a chance that it all falls apart, and you actually decrease that by increasing your variance.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, I think in a certain sense it comes down to, like, if you're not the best of the best, get weird. You know, like, teams should not be afraid to get weird in the micro sense, you know, like the Raptors are doing this year, where they're changing their defense all the time, I said micro sense, right? Not macro. Get weird in the micro sense like the Raptors, or get weird in the macro sense like the Rockets. You know, like, I think that that's a perfectly viable strategy to raise the ceiling of a team that may not be the most talented. I do think one of the interesting things that motivated the Capella trade, even just apart from having to change your team up a little bit, and this is something that Kevin O'Connor brought up, and like, Kevin, so sorry about your dad, man. Like, he told us all yesterday that, you know, his father passed away a couple days ago. It's really terrible. And, you know, he had sort of been sharing that journey that he'd gone on with his dad's cancer diagnosis over the last couple of years. He'd been sharing that on Twitter. You know, prayers go out to the O'Connor family. I think it's him and his mom. It's terrible. And this was, like, at the deadline, Kevin made the point that the Rockets had gone from the most screen and roll heavy team in the league to the least. And that's what Capella's best at. And if you're not going to have him doing the thing he's best at, he sort of becomes superfluous and you can just get somebody that fits better. And now he's in Atlanta and they are the most screen and roll heavy team in the league. So that'll probably work really well for him there.
And that ties in with another one of the big storylines that happened at the deadline, which was teams that had a lot of cap space betting against it. And in one case with the Drummond trade, teams making opposite bets. And for Atlanta, the biggest part of it for them was functionally they traded probably the 16th pick in the 2020 draft for Clint Capella. And so there, I mean, they were looking at more cap space than anybody would have known what to do with in a weak free agent class. And they decided that having Capella on that contract was more valuable to them than that first round pick. And I think there's a rationale there. I think he was the best player available, definitely the best combination of player and contract for them specifically. You brought up the screen and roll stuff. Also, the Hawks needed a player who could potentially help give them a defensive identity. And while Capella is not perfect, he can help them there. And also an evaluation lens for John Collins, who I don't think should be as set, locked in, a part of their future. So from the Hawks' perspective, they, you know, and Capella, the difference between them and what Memphis did, and we'll talk about that in a minute, is that the Hawks didn't close the door. They just closed it on the ridiculous, like, $70 million in cap space by getting Capella and then by getting Dwayne Dedman, where there they didn't add as much money, but it also didn't, you know, there they were able to get a player who fit in well with what they did last year.
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make. Like, Atlanta, yes, they took on a bunch of money for next year, but they've still got, I think, like close to 45 or 50 million in cap space potentially. So they could still do essentially what Memphis did last summer, you know, take on contracts that teams don't want and get picks out of it or get players out of it. Like, if they can get their version of DeAnthony Melton, that would be great. You know, Atlanta can still do that. Memphis, you know, as you mentioned, and I think you and Nate talked about this on the podcast, and then Nate talked about it with Hollinger on their podcast, where they vaporized just about all of their cap space, I believe, for the offseason. And that obviously forecloses the opportunity of them doing the same thing they did last summer with great success. To me, I think it's a little bit more justifiable from their perspective, because the free agent market is not good. And obviously you don't have to use your cap space on free agents, but I do think foreclosing yourself to paying below average free agents above average money or star level money is justifiable. So the free agent market is not good. They're not drawing good free agents there anyway. They got a player who is essentially a perfect fit for the rest of their core and is still very young, and they got him on a very affordable contract for next year and a team option the year after. And then because the free agent market is so much better in 21 than it is in 20, those contracts that they took on that expire next year are so much more valuable than expiring contracts were this year. You know, like, plus they now have a bunch of mid-sized contracts that can be used to either aggregate them together or to find somebody, you know, that's a better long-term fit for them. Like, now they have Gorgui Dieng at 17.5, Tyus Jones at 8.9, Kyle Anderson at 9.5. I think Josh Jackson is up after this year. So it's those three guys, plus even Winslow if they decide that he's not the right fit for them. They have so many of those contracts that could be used either in isolation or together to find either another star or another guy that fits better to what they want to do. And I think because they have not just the top star like the Hawks do in Trey and the Grizzlies do in John Morant, they also have the second star or second, like, close to star in Jaren Jackson and other really high-level contributors in Brandon Clark and Dylan Brooks and even Valanciunas and DeAnthony Melton and other guys that can contribute at a high level for them. I mean, they even have Jonas's contract if they decide that, you know, Jaren Jackson's ready to play center. I don't know that he necessarily is, and Jonas does a lot of good things for them, but
they also have so many more options. Theoretically, as a backup five if they want to move Jaren to the starting five. Like, they could do something like that. Play Winslow at the four and move Jaren there, and so you don't have to get a replacement starter. Also, replacement starting five is very easy.
Yeah, they have, I think, so many more options to deal with than the Hawks did. So I do think it's a little bit more justifiable for them.
I like to think about this in terms of opportunity cost, and it is a very – and I'm working on a piece for The Athletic that talks about this. And the challenge for me is squaring my own expectations, because generally for me, vaporizing – $40 million in space, you go, okay, well, what is it worth it? Really, what they got for that $40 million space is they got Justice Winslow, as you said, reasonable contract for a couple of years. Also notable that if he makes it all the way to the end, even if they decline the team option, the Grizzlies will have full bird rights on him. So that, you know, it doesn't guarantee that he's come back. They won't have match rights or anything like that. But, you know, it is an advantage if things go well. And they also were able to get Dylan Brooks at what I feel is a below market price, 3 years, $45 million. And one of the stranger things about that, I just found this out from Eric Pincus when he put in the contract, is that they did
it goes up then down.
It goes up then down, and so that means the richest year of it is 2021, which doesn't make much sense to me. I thought that would be the year that they'd be trying to strike in free agency. Maybe there's something that Zach Kleiman in their front office knows about their planning that I don't. It seems weird to me. And generally, when a team does something like that, I'm like, huh, okay. You keep it in your mind because they deliberately made that structure. And so wonder what that was. Keep in the back of minds. So getting Dylan Brooks below market, getting Justice Winslow, assuming the health stuff is clean enough. And I mean, the players are playing for their new team, so presumably it was clean enough for the Grizzlies at least. And I think, I'm a little bit torn, because the challenge with all of the major levers that you think of for an offseason are weak this year. So free agents, not a strong class, especially not in terms of young guys who would fit in their timeline. You know, the best players in the free agent class are not going to be available to the Grizzlies because they're going to be matched. You know, it's not like they're going to use their cap space to get Brandon Ingram, because Brandon Ingram's not going anywhere. You know, that sort of a thing isn't there. And I also, because the free agent class is so weak, there isn't as much leverage to exert over the teams that – there aren't going to be as many teams
trying to get – that was the next point I was going
to
make.
Trying to get cap space.
Who's giving up a first to get cap space to sign, like – I don't know. Is someone giving up a first to get the cap space to sign Fred VanVleet away from the Raptors?
Probably
maybe?
Not. Maybe, but probably not. And does Fred VanVleet want to go somewhere else? You know, like, does that even matter? And the, you know, Ingram is one of the most exciting guys in the market. You know, if AD gets on the market, then maybe that changes things, but I don't expect him to, you know, gets on the market, meaning he actually considers leaving the Lakers. Not that he's technically a free agent, because he will be. I already broke that down. But it's a real consideration for the Grizzlies that the opportunity cost is a lot lower.
Ugh, Bodie, stop it. Sorry, my dog just stepped on.
That's all right. It's a part of the fun of recording the way that we do. But yeah, but so the cost to Memphis is lower. I don't know. To me, Justice Winslow is not worth it, even if the opportunity cost is lower. But the theory behind it is sound. I mean, Winslow, that he can handle the ball a little bit. I think they want somebody who can do that. I lamented the idea that they, you know, that with what Memphis is going to look for in that other perimeter guy, you know, now that they have Brooks and Ja Morant kind of locked in. And maybe it's just Winslow at the three, maybe it's him at the four, and they add somebody else. But the other huge part of this for the Grizzlies is that maybe the bet is that they do this in 2021, and at that point, the problem is that there's going to be a lot of other contenders, but maybe they're trying to make the same case that we've all been penciling in for Dallas, which is, okay, you're not. This isn't a major market. This isn't the, you know, the Lake a glamour franchise in terms of the Knicks or the Lakers or whatever. But we're a really good young team that has this space to burn. You can have a role depending on what player they're pursuing, and that might work for somebody. Maybe they're not going after Giannis. Maybe they're going after that year's Paul Millsap. And I haven't identified yet who those players could be. It's such a wide open year that it could go. But I get that for Memphis. And also, their team is so young that maybe they want a little bit more time to figure out what they actually have. But it is a pretty significant thing. And then the other part of why, this is the part that makes me queasy about it, I was getting at this before, is while a lot of the levers are going in the direction of this not being as valuable, the part that is too hard for me to write off now is that you never know what could present itself. And that could be a team needs a facilitator for a trade. So it's not that they're signing high-profile free agent X. It's that they're trying to make a trade for, I don't know, Karl-Anthony Towns, Giannis, whoever that player is, and there aren't that many facilitators around right now. And maybe they could exert some value there. It's not going to be as much as, like, obviously the Thunder got for Paul George or the AD trade or anything like that, but it can be value. And really, functionally, that's the role that the Grizzlies actually played in the, if you think about the Warriors' whole situation as an ecosystem, they were more of a facilitator than anything else, and there can be value there, even if we don't see it at the beginning, and even if some teams going into last offseason didn't see it and just took themselves out of that race.
Yeah, if that makes sense. I do think it's a valid criticism. I also think that at a certain point, like, we're criticizing so many, maybe they could have done this and maybe they could have done that.
Right. And I think that's I think that's totally fair. And it's also hard because it's my instinct. And a lot of the factors here are going in favor of this not being a tough thing for Memphis. Another loser in that sense of the trade deadline is that Memphis, if they're – it looks like they're going to be competitive this year. Yeah, they did trade Jay Crowder and, I mean, Iguodala wasn't playing for them. But the pick they're sending to Boston, not only is it in the looking like it's going to be the 2020 draft, but it's going to be a worse pick than we anticipated. And Boston benefited a lot from that dynamic in the Kyrie Irving trade. It was the mystery box, oh, hey, what's that pick going to be? It ended up becoming Colin Sexton. And now I think they're being hurt by that of the, oh, the Memphis pick, that's going to be the next great way that Boston gets better. And now it's, you know, it could potentially, if Memphis makes the playoffs, let's say the Lillard injury is worse than we expected, Memphis continues to play well, that could end up being, you know, like the 16th pick in a draft that people don't like.
The same thing happened to them last year with the Kings pick.
Absolutely. That's another great example.
And I think that, you know, even though they lost Jay Crowder, I think Memphis might have actually helped their chances to make the playoffs this season with this trade by cutting Solomon Hill out of the rotation, giving more minutes to Kyle Anderson, who, just because of his passing, makes for such an easy fit with their other guys out there. And because he's so low usage and he's such a good passer and he's just such a different player than so many of the other guys they have on their roster. I think he makes a lot of sense starting for them. I think we've seen that over these last couple games. And then when Winslow comes back, he's such a connector piece that allows you to play in so many different ways. You can play him at the four, you can play him at the three, you can use him as a small ball center, you could use him as your backup point guard if you don't like what Tyus Jones is giving you on a certain night. Like, he just gives you so many different looks, and just from one player to be able to provide that many things, you know, once he ever gets healthy, if and when he does, that I think is a benefit for them too. And then just what you were talking about with the potential of going after somebody in free agency, I think obviously Dallas has the advantage of having Luka. The Grizzlies have the advantage of their second and third stars not being on big contracts yet, like Porzingis is. Their best guys are going to be on still their rookie deals. You know, John, Jaren Jackson combined are going to make far less money than Luka and Porzingis.
However, there's a counter, which is that Dallas has the benefit of an owner who is willing to pay. Like, we know that if Dallas has the opportunity to get somebody good and then have to pay Luka on top of that, that Mark Cuban is going to do it. We don't know that with Robert Parra right now.
That's definitely true. But just in terms of having the cap space available to pay the star,
sure,
I do think the Grizzlies have a little bit of an advantage just in terms of their star guys are going to make less, and it's better to have to trade a supporting guy to create a little bit more space than it is to have to trade a starting guy.
Also, the Grizzlies will have flexibility that summer. There are going to be so many teams with cap space that if they need to clear a little bit of extra, there are a lot of different ways that they can do it. They can trade Kyle Anderson. They could stretch Kyle Anderson. Same thing with Tyus Jones. Both those guys are going to make about $9-10 million that year. Valanciunas will be making 14. That's not a terrible contract. We don't know exactly where the cap is going from here. But yeah, so they don't have
starting center money by then.
It depending. I mean, maybe starting center money is actually going to go down, but we don't know that with the overall dynamics in the league. But yeah, I think that's going to be a time to strike. And it's possible another kind of pin to keep in there is there's an outside chance that Memphis could actually push back to 22. The challenge there would be Jaren Jackson's cap hold goes up. But if Jackson ends up being one of those players who is good but isn't quite max player good, you could either agree to an extension and then lower his number immediately, or they could have an understanding that, hey, if we get a star, then we're going to, and you get a lower cap number, then we'll lower it and move it that way. Because Ja still is so far away from his own boost that they could end up really working for them. And then Ja and Brandon Clark will be restricted in the same year, and that's 23. So they might have another chance at this. We'll have to take a look. And I still don't love this move for them, but the possibility of it working out is there. And then the other weird group of teams for me, and some of these have resolved with buyouts, a couple of them, is that there were a bunch of teams that had these narrow pathways to use contracts to get guys use expirings to get guys that are on multi-year contracts. And to an extent, that's what the Cavs did with the Dante Exum Jordan Clarkson trade, was Dante Exum signed for another year. We'll see whether that works out, but that was kind of the theory behind it. And in some ways, Cleveland did that with Andre Drummond as well. But the Mavs had that with Courtney Lee. The Pelicans had that with Darius Miller, who inspired me to write an entire piece about the concept of the walking trade exception. And a couple other teams had these expiring contracts that they just basically let wither on the vine. OKC did this with Andre Roberson, and that was a little bit weird to me, because in some ways that was found money, because there are always teams that are looking to shed multi-year contracts, even if it wasn't as pressing for some of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible just that the guys that they wanted to get were not available in that type of trade. You know, not everybody's going to be willing to trade those multi-year guys, especially if you're looking to take on a multi-year guy that's like actually good.
Right, like San Antonio, for example. San Antonio might not have wanted to trade Rudy Gay, who is a player that I had brought up for this idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible. Like, let's say the Thunder wanted to get Rudy Gay, who would have been, I think, a pretty decent fit for them as, you know, another one of those guys, like, you know, backup Gallo as another 3-4 type off the bench. Maybe San Antonio didn't want Andre Roberson and second-round picks. You know, like, they're still trying to make the playoffs, too. You know, maybe a doomed attempt, but obviously that streak is important to them. They don't make midseason trades really anyway. You know, it's possible those types of deals just weren't available. The teams that I think are more worthy of criticism for not trading their expiring guys are the Charlottes and the Knickses, where, like, you really couldn't have gotten a second-round pick even for Marvin Williams, or you couldn't have gotten a second-round pick for Wayne Ellington. Like, those are teams that have so many holes on their roster and have players that have seemingly actual value. Like, Marvin Williams got snatched up in, what, 8.5 seconds on the buyout market? Obviously, his number is big, so maybe nobody would have wanted traded, you know, something for him in
think about Dallas for this. So Dallas, yes, they got MKG, and I think that's going to work out well for them. But they could have gotten Marvin Williams for Courtney Lee and had both guys. That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, they had the filler salary, and maybe they like Courtney Lee better. I mean, it was weird that he got marginalized for basically the entire season before the last, like, week. But maybe they're going that direction. And yeah, I mean, you can think about somebody like New Orleans or a lot of these teams that had wiggle room. And it does go both ways. And this is something Dan Feldman and I talked about last week, to criticize teams for deals they don't make because we don't know how to calibrate it. But it does seem like, especially with Marvin and with Marvin Williams, that something could have been there. And I mean, you could say the same for, you brought up the Knicks. I mean, they have all these players that are on very lightly guaranteed deals for next year, many of which will probably, they'll just cut the guy and either stretch that money or more likely just take the hit. Some of them, like maybe Reggie Bullock, they'll keep around, but they got a lot of value from Marcus Morris, and good on the Knicks for actually trading him, which was 100% the right decision. But just not creating any value for everybody else. Like, I think there's a chance, you would know better than I am, that they might just keep Elfrid Payton too.
They might. Certainly, he's been their best point guard, I think, this year, just in terms of what they actually need from a point guard, which is to create literally one easy shot for anybody, because they don't have many other guys that can do that. I'm not 100% sure they'll keep him, especially because it looks like obviously the front office leadership is going to be changing. And if Scott Perry is not there, there's not anybody with, you know, ties to Elfrid Payton that wanted to bring him in and like is his quote unquote guy. You know, I don't know what Leon Rose feels about Elfrid Payton. I don't know what World Wide West, if he's joining in an official or unofficial capacity, thinks about Elfrid Payton. Obviously, Scott Perry is much higher on him than just about anybody else, so that obviously affects things in the future. I think it was probably a little bit harder for them to trade someone like Taj Gibson or Bobby Portis, just because the size of their salary makes it probable that you have to include somebody that's like actually worth something or is just such bad money in a deal, and that complicates things. But Wayne Ellington's only making what, like $5 or $6 million a year? Like, the Lakers couldn't have used him for Rondo and nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bullock, same thing.
Could have gotten, like, for DeMarcus Cousins. Like, granted, the Lakers are not an asset-rich team, but somebody could have done something.
DeMarcus Cousins and one second-round pick is better for the Knicks than, you know, having Bullock, who they're not doing anything with. You know, I think that, them and Charlotte are the teams you can criticize more so than, you know, playoff teams where you may have just not been able to get the kind of guys that you wanted for those salaries that don't make sense on your roster and that'll just die on the vine.
Last thing I want to talk about with you, we're about 2 months from the playoffs, and one of the big things, of course, we'll both be watching is the new faces and new places. I think that kind of goes without saying that we'll keep an eye on that. But I like asking people, so you get a week off of thinking about this, but after that, what teams, what players are you going to be most interested in watching?
I think it's sort of the teams in the second tier of each conference. Like, who is the team that's going to separate itself as being able to challenge the Bucks? Who is the team that's going to separate itself as being able to challenge, you know, the Lakers and the Clippers and possibly, you know, the Nuggets or the Jazz? Like, who are the teams that are going to step up and be in the conference finals against those best teams? That's kind of what I'm looking for, you know, at the top end. The back end, like, who decides that they do want the best lottery odds, even in a year that everybody seems to hate the draft? I mean, everybody likes to say having the best lottery odds doesn't matter. We literally got a concrete example last year of it mattering. Like, the Knicks fell to 3 instead of to 6 or 7. Like, even though they wound up missing on, you know, a top 2 that looks like it's much better than the rest, you certainly would have rather been at 3 than 6 or 7. That has value. Is there a team that says, screw it, we're going to go all the way to the bottom, whether it's the Warriors, I mean, who apparently are going to bring Steph back, so maybe it's not going to be them. You know, is it the Cavs? Is it the Hawks? Can the Knicks get themselves into that mix? Is it the Wolves? I think that that's interesting, too, just because everybody thinks it doesn't have value. It clearly does, and we got a concrete example of that last year.
I will echo all of those, especially that second tier in the West. I just need to figure out who's good and who isn't from that group. That'll be a big question. The Rockets are high on that list for a bunch of different reasons. But then the other collection, and this is true in the West and not the East, is the, I call them the next teams. And so that is this group of young ones, and Dallas is better than Memphis and New Orleans. I would say they're probably the next ones, where we're not as much looking at how good are they right now, it's looking a year, two, three out and saying, okay, this is the early stages of where this is going. So for Memphis, mm-hmm. Ja, Jaren, Dylan Brooks, hopefully Justice Winslow, how does that look? And it's not about necessarily regular season wins and everything else, but then the giant one for me is the New Orleans Pelicans and Zion. I mean, Zion has been so fascinating, and in many ways he is the player that I thought he would be, and the question was, would it work? And I would say mostly it has. There's still, I mean, he's not going to shoot 40% from three forever, and hopefully he'll shoot better than 59% from the free throw line at some point. But he is physically dominant in a very different way that I think is really exciting. And now David Griffin, you know, we all wish that it happened from day one instead of day 50, but he gets some time now to evaluate how this team is going to work. And New Orleans has the complete capacity to overhaul, because one of the key ways, and this is something I harp on a lot, of when people say tear down Team X, is, well, what does that actually look like? And mm-hmm. a key problem there, and this is something that Charlotte dealt with, is if you want to tear down and the players that you have on big money contracts are negative value, it is incredibly hard to actually do anything. And so that was part of why I was believing in the Hornets over and everything else like that. We'll see how that turns out. But New Orleans, as far as I can tell, every single player that they have on a multi-year contract is a value contract. So Drew Holiday, about $26 million a year after this year. JJ Redick, 1 year, 13 after this year. Lonzo, 1 for 11, isn't going to make everyone thrilled, but I think on the right situation, and that situation might be New Orleans, he's a really good fit. And then Melly and all their other cheap guys, of course, they're cheap. And I don't know yet if David Griffin has an expectation of where this all goes. And okay, what is Zion's best defensive position? What is his offensive position? Does Derek Favors make sense? But A, you get to watch a lot of Zion, and just like Ja, that's exhilarating. But also, as somebody who loves thinking about this from a general manager's perspective, figuring out where he wants to go with this is, and where I would go, that's something, like, people sometimes say that sometimes, like, oh, if you got control of this team, what would you do? And if somebody asked me, what would I do if I were the Pelicans, my answer would be, let me tell you in 2 months.
Yeah, it might even be, let me tell you, in a year and a half.
Sure.
You know, like,
very well could be.
Zion playing a full season after having, you know, the entire offseason to get himself, like, I think the concerns about him being fat or out of shape or whatever are overblown. Like, even, like, clearly not in the best shape of his life. He's the most athletic player on the floor. Most times it's not particularly close. So, like, what difference does it make? But to get himself in even better shape than he is now and come back and play a full season, like, that's a potentially much different player than even the guy that we see on the court right now. Maybe he can play center. Maybe he can switch on to anybody. You know, like, we don't know what they're going to be, and we don't know what the rest of the guys are going to look like around him, and he's already this good, this fast, despite, like, not even really being himself yet. You can take your time.
The rust, the physical and mental rust that comes with this, jumping into an NBA season midstream, but much, much more doing it as a rookie is incredible.
And I think they need to take a lesson from the Anthony Davis era where they were like, we have to start winning right now, and we're going to trade multiple first-round picks for Omer Asik and Alexis Ajinsa. And, like, don't do that this time. You know, take your time. There's no need to try to skip steps. You're going to level up at some point because you have that guy and he's that good to the point where it's going to be almost impossible for you to not be really good at some point anyway. And the same was probably true of Anthony Davis if you didn't completely deprive yourself of all assets to improve the team around him. You don't need to do that this time around. Take your time, figure out what he is, figure out who fits with him and who doesn't. And because the other guys around him, even if they're not perfect fits, like you mentioned, they're all on pretty decently valuable contracts. You can turn them into something else and something good and something valuable somewhere down the line if you decide that they're not perfect fits. And then you just in terms of what you said, in terms of the teams that are, you know, quote unquote next, you know, certainly more of them reside in the West than in the East. Like the teams at the bottom of the East right now, I mean, maybe the only one that looks the potential to level up at any time soon looks like Atlanta, just because they at least look like they have a foundational star or close to it in Trae Young. The rest of the teams at the bottom of the East really don't. And that just reminds me, like I've said this a bunch of times, I will never, ever, ever get over the Knicks not getting the number one or two pick this year. I'll never get over it. It's like the new where Steph went one pick ahead of them.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to get over there. And especially if this ends up being a non-star heavy group, it might take even longer for that paradigm to shift. And that's like one of the huge differences for me between the East and West right now is how hard is it to make a case for the non-playoff teams to be playoff teams in the near future? And Washington gets that because they'll get John Wall back and they can, I think they're better run now, so maybe they can add a little bit more depth and their age the passage of time could help them. But
better run than they were under Ernie Grunfeld?
I know.
No way.
It's a huge bar. I don't know if they can handle it. But, I mean, a lot of these teams, the Cavs to me are an amazing example of this, which makes the Drummond trade so fascinating, of it's going to take a while. Like, they're not good enough now, and to build up the base, Pat, you know, maybe Sexton and Garland are better in a couple of years, but they're so terrible defensively, and wings forwards are so hard to find. It's going to take them a while, it's going to take the Knicks a while. The Hawks might be closer, because Trey can be a linchpin in some of those things, but, like, also the Pistons, they're a long way away.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Hornets probably are.
Although I'm in the Christian Wood hive. Like, oh, absolutely. That dude is good.
I think so, too. And
honestly, trade might hurt them because he's going to be more expensive.
And Wood, it's so appropriate that he's an unrestricted free agent this year because
yes.
He is such a gigantic wild card and is also an example of why I didn't love the Hawks giving up so much cap space and tying up the centers is, while I think Capella is a better fit for Wood for them than Wood will be on his next contract, there's a possibility that he just gets underpaid by the market and somebody could just swoop in and get him at a price. And like that's something Memphis theoretically could have done if they had a little bit of space. And I wonder who that team is. And I know that I want it to be the Hornets just because they need that infusion and it would be really fun to see them get that upside. They're one of those teams with it. And that doesn't have an answer at center. So we'll see. But it could be – I wonder how his free agency is going to go.
Yeah, I mean, look, a lot of the young guys are restricted this offseason, and it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, to pry them away. When you have a guy – like I think he's just a legit good player. And when you have a guy that's good and an unrestricted free agent, and I think he's, what, like 23 or 24? Like – that's not something that comes on the market all that often.
Christian Wood is 24. He will play next season at 25. That is really young for the amount of stuff he's gone through in the league.
Yes. What is he? He's been on like five different teams or something, right?
He has played in games for five different teams.
Yeah.
And that doesn't even include his I remember Bodner's tweets about when he was going back and forth to Delaware and all that type of stuff and then into Greensboro.
I remember all of, you know, Process Twitter tweeting about, like, we got to bring up Christian Wood all the time back in the early days of the Process.
Well, I think we've covered more than enough ground, so thank you so much for taking the time. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks again to Jared Dubin for taking the time to come on. You can read his work all over the internet, and you can also follow him on Twitter at JADubin5. That's JADubin, and then the number 5. Love talking with him, and this is a great time of year to talk with Jared because, like me, he's a cap nerd and a basketball analyst savvy in his own right, and that combination can be really useful this time of year to get a sense of where things are and where they're going. And, I mean, Jared and I met years ago. I don't know if it was HP, Hardwood Paroxysm, or we worked together at Mid-Level Exceptional. I actually took over running that site from him, so I worked under him and then replaced him, and then that was a great experience for me, hopefully for both of us. And now we're getting into the All-Star break. There are going to be no games that count towards the score sheet, though, of course, if you want to watch All-Star and dunk contest and all that fun stuff, you absolutely can. I'm going to actually really take some time off this year. That's something that I've enjoyed doing the last couple. And we're going to recharge. Probably will have some writing at The Athletic. I have a piece that's just in the submission phase right now. So that'll probably come up. And, you know, if I have some time, I'll probably do some writing. Real GM Radio, as always, will come out every week. So there will be a new episode next week. Don't know the timing yet, but I already do have a guest lined up, as long as we can figure everything out. But that's why it's a great reason to subscribe and download every episode. That is so important with a show like this that doesn't come out on a specific day of the week. Also, word of mouth, very important, whether that's telling your friends or telling people on social media, whatever it is, really do appreciate it. And leaving a rating, leaving a review. That is important so that other people can find the show. It's great if it's Apple Podcasts. I understand if it's not. And if you want to be awesome, you can leave a review both places. But the most important thing for this show and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors for this episode. That is BetOnline. Use that Podcast One promo code for a 50% sign-up bonus. And you can also now check out the podcast on Spotify, which is pretty exciting. People have asked about that before, and it is done now. I talked about that a little bit last week, so you can check it out there if that is your preferred podcast player. And they are certainly becoming more aggressive in the business as a provider as well, which is exciting for all of us in this world. Just have more people who are invested in it is always a good thing. You can also check out Dunked On. Nate and I are on a form of hiatus as well, but we did a lot of great trade deadline analysis, and then we did a 15 and 60 on all of the teams that didn't make moves at the deadline. We will do a companion one to that after the break and get into everything else. And we will actually do our first position ranking. We recorded the shooting guards, and we will release that next week. I don't know what date Nate wants to release it, but it is already recorded. Also, Nate and I did a Patreon mailbag that you can check out as well. So lots of stuff for you to consume while we are on break. And thank you so much for listening. And if you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. I try to respond when I can, but that's not my promise. My promise is to read it. And really do appreciate that. I get stuff all the time on various things, suggested guests, or, hey, talk about this, or whatever else. And it can go into other things. Sometimes it ends up being piece suggestions or anything else. So thank you so much for listening. Take care, and make it a great day.